Welcome, guys, to the first QDD podcast.
Thank you.
It's a small initiative from a group of people who has the goal to raise the quality awareness in the Mendix community. And you guys have been chosen to be the first guests in our podcast.
Wow, an honor.
Thank you.
A big honor.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, and of course, thank you so Presteria for hosting the first podcast, for lending us the equipment.
No problem at all.
Great. Yeah. So, well, let's first do a short introduction for the fellow people who might not know you guys already. So, Leon, you can start first.
I'm Leon from the Netherlands and now part of the Mendix community for I think about 9.5 years, almost reaching my 10-year anniversary end of this year. And I'm a Mendix maker, so very autodidact. Is that an English word? Autodidact?
You told yourself.
Yeah. I'm very much self-taught. I don't listen to a lot of podcasts. I don't read a lot of books. I have not, 10 years ago, I didn't attend a training. There were a few. And of course, in projects I learned from others, but I'm an autodidact person, always tinkering. That's what I like to do. Currently working for Blue Green Solutions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Leon, for your introduction. Then let's also introduce Wouter.
Yeah, introducing myself is a bit weird, but I'm Wouter, MVP expert, working for Sopresteria. What should people know about me? I organize quite a few meetups every year, and quality is a recurring theme in that. And one of the things I always try to do is take a careful look at the newest things that are basically out with Mendix and try to really get a proper understanding of the feature also under the hood so that we're capable of delivering quality stuff in the end. So, that's basically it. I've got a background in English in teaching, by the way, so sorry if it sounds a bit posh every now and then.
And sorry if we mispronounce certain words.
I'll correct you if you want to.
All right. Thank you, Wouter, for introducing yourself. Thank you, Leon, for introducing yourself. Two big names for our first podcast. So thank you for joining. And I think as a nice, easy start, let's just start the topic with the question, what is quality to you? Well, let me give Leon the first word.
All right, I hope it will not become two separate monologues instead of a dialogue, but I'll do my best.
I'll try to intervene.
Yes, feel free. I was thinking about this on the way here. Quality to me, it has a fundamental layer and a more flexible layer when it comes to certain aspects of quality. For me, the fundamental layer is reliability and security. Those are fundamental. I think that if you ask somebody to do your plumbing, you don't want it to leak after 6 months, no matter what kind of plumbing you want it to be as reliable as long as possible, and you want it to be secure that there is not a fire or that you don't die because there is water and electricity.
Does the same go for your app?
I hope not many apps kill people that I made. So thank God. For me, the same counts for software development, reliable and secure. And then on top of that, the flexible layer where you have performance, where you have maintainability, flexibility, reduction of complexity.
But that is interesting that you're calling out performance as an optional bit that goes on top of reliability and security.
Yeah.
Isn't performance part of reliability?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So everything has overlap. So reducing complexity has overlap with maintainability. But we have to use the words that we have in order to kind of address what it is to me. I put it separately because I don't. A lot of software that you make, mm-hmm. Something can take 100 times longer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a reduction in performance of 100-fold, which sounds terrible for quality. But if it's the difference between 60 milliseconds and 6,000 milliseconds, and it only runs in the night, then yeah, who cares? If the customer doesn't care, should it reduce quality?
So that's why you're saying performance sometimes is an optional aspect of reliability.
It's in the flexible layer where it can either be really important or not that important.
Okay.
So I see it as an aspect of quality, but in a varying level of importance. Same as the other things. Maintainability. Some things don't even need to be maintained. They run and nobody looks at them anymore.
Okay.
What do you think?
I feel that part of the difficulty of talking about quality in software engineering is that there is so much to pay attention to, right? So let's just take Mendix, right? So, and then even within Mendix, we can talk about quality on probably hundreds of different aspects that are out there. So for me, quality mostly is about having a conversation with the client about what needs to be done, in what fashion, and when that is good enough. And I think performance, reliability, maintainability, security, these are always integral parts of the conversation. But for us, it's having that, or at least for me, it's having that conversation in the first place, very carefully finding out what the wishes of the client are. And then usually you will be able to find out whether it's 60 or 6 milliseconds or 6,000 for that matter. And the second part of this for me is writing down what you agree upon. So that sounds really silly, maybe. That quality in delivery or in delivering an application consists of writing down exactly what you agreed upon. But in the end, I found that in order to prevent future discussions from occurring, let's say you're off the project, the next developer is off the project, and you find out a certain issue with an application, right? And you say, who built it like this? We all recognize that feeling probably, that you take a first look at an application and that you're thinking, why in heaven's name did someone choose to implement this?
Yeah, I started asking why.
But then it can be really handy to sort of look back at the original requirement and see part of the discussion that was there initially when it was constructed. So for me, part of a qualitative delivery is also writing down what was agreed and discussed partly. Yeah. And then still, even if you write it down, you might discover that it's very, not complete.
That makes everything arbitrary. If you say everything's in the flexible layer. So,
did I say that?
So what if now you're saying that the conversation, right?
It's a conversation.
All the quality is in the conversation. So it's in the eye of everything's in the eye of the beholder. There is no there are no fundamentals to quality. Everything's in the eye of the beholder.
Well, I do have an expectation of quality, especially with regard to a platform like Mendix, that certain things regarding security should be in order.
Yeah.
And I'm saying should be because you can always develop stuff incorrectly and then it becomes unsafe, right? But that's the basic premise which you're working off of. And usually these parts of the conversation you try to avoid as well. And then it comes down to... It all comes down to discussing what is required. Yeah. One of these interesting bits...
But I never have that discussion with my plumber. He doesn't talk to me first. He just does his... He's a specialist. He does what he does. And you're
completely happy with the work that the plumber does.
I found one where that indeed is the case. But what I mean is he's a specialist.
Yeah.
He knows what he's doing. At least I pay him so he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
So he has very little conversation to me when it comes to, okay, and now I want to talk to you about the level of quality that I am going to make for you. I'm like, what do you mean? Just you do a good job. So there are certain walks in life where you don't have to discuss the quality that you're getting because
And it does depend, in a sense, because we all know.
But you're saying software development is so complex that there is no.
No, I'm basically saying we all rely on that expert that you're describing, right? So that plumber probably has done thousands of installations and probably knows really well how to weld two pipes together. Yeah. Yeah. So that's not the issue, but the issue may be in the design. Maybe in trapping an air bubble and using a quick shortcut instead of having an extra curve or
duct tape. I've seen that.
There are shortcuts, right? And that is something that, especially I think within the field of Mendix, I think we can say that in general we need more attention to quality, I think.
Absolutely.
Because we can build with speed and say, hey, we've got a safe platform so we can build anything. But the craftsmanship that goes into quality, just like with the plumber description, that craftsmanship should also get more attention, I think.
Yeah, because what I wanted to get to was, like, I don't know what I should tell my plumber if I want high quality welding, for example, right? So mm-hmm. so then you can't find it in the conversation.
That's interesting. And do we all know on all aspects of Mendix what is the entailment of quality in that sense for every aspect of Mendix? And I have to be honest, Mendix is growing so fast, it's really difficult sometimes to keep up, especially with all the LLMs that you can now employ right within Mendix. I haven't tried that out because basically the assignments that I've done
haven't included any
form of AI because of AI fears regarding data and data breaches and training and all of that stuff. But it's definitely something that I'd like to look into a bit more in the coming period. And that's at least what I try to do. So if there is something new out there, I try to go and figure it out. And some of these bits are a bit more difficult than other bits. And the key element in that is getting the proper craftsmanship level to be able to do an assignment properly.
I think that's a great one that we're also addressing later, right? Craftsmanship when it comes to quality. But I think we can agree upon the fact that several aspects that are flexible and that depend on the problem.
Yeah.
And so depending on the problem, there are varying aspects of importance in the quality of our solution. Very meta.
Yeah, very meta. Yeah. But it's simply not an easy conversation.
Yeah.
It's a very complicated topic. And I think if you really dive into the details, and which we're going to do in a bit, so we're going to look at specific areas, but then you'll probably also find that quality, the exact image that a person has of what is a qualitative implementation will also differ. In the first project I ever did at a previous employer, I was also asked to do some styling, and it was with a very experienced styler, a Mendix developer. And she was very helpful. Thank you very much, Shana. And I learned a lot about how to organize your style files and how to make sure that the project was properly maintainable and that all of these little classes that you wrote were in the proper folders for each widget and that you had a mix-in folder, etc. So that was really a proper view of what qualitative styling within Mendix probably is. And then I went to the next project in which we had a huge styling module for a company that was already created. And the basic idea there was that we had to stick to what was in that styling module, and we couldn't extend, in principle, what was in that module. And if we did, we had to put it in one place. Because that one place, main.scss, would then be analyzed, and all of those bits could be translated back into the various folders in the styling module. And then in the end, it turned out that we actually had to do a huge lot of styling. So it was over 1,500 lines of styling that ended up in main.scss. But from that point on, for me, I think especially working with companies that have a more advanced sense of what their app should look like and that have their own style guides, that means basically making the changes that you add to your application itself very localized, very easily trackable, probably with an annotation saying, hey, this still has to be cleaned up into the
what do you mean by localized?
So I put it in one place, basically. Okay, so there's one document in which all of these changes are visible so that they're also easily replaced in the proper destination when it comes to that.
Can I ask a silly question?
Yeah.
So Mendix also has a section styling, and you have the possibility to do inline styling there.
That
is the most localized because it's right at the point where you're also interacting with the rest of the code.
Yeah.
But
I feel something coming here.
Yeah, there's a lot of opinions about that.
Should we use that box, right? That inline styling box.
I haven't used it for quite a while, mm-hmm. but it is in the platform, mm-hmm. and it's hard to miss. Because it's the biggest box that nobody uses, I think. It's on the right side of the screen. Because you're talking good quality also means that it should be easy. We should not overcomplicate things.
Yeah.
So my question is how far can we go in not overcomplicating it?
And I think you're touching upon maintainability and so, like not repeating yourself, right? So basically, if you're using inline styling, then you're repeating the same variables and bits over and over and over again instead of using classes. And in that sense, I know.
Maybe you're only using the class once.
Yeah, good point.
So if you start from there.
Yeah. So there's one use case for me in which I personally use this every now and then.
Yeah, for me as well, testing. I'm testing things out. I don't go, because beforehand, Mendix used to not compile the SCSS automatically. So you had to spin up your Koala or another compiler and you had to restart everything.
Yeah.
So I'm from that period of time. So then it was, then if you had to do all of that anyway, I just used the... If I was working on one page, I kind of used that, hijacked that section for getting it right and then putting it somewhere.
Yeah, understand. Yeah.
When were you using it?
Usually when I want to have an inline version of display none. So when something has to be on the page, but I don't want it to be displayed ever. Because basically inline styling, cascading style sheets, right? So if you do it inline, it won't be displayed even when someone applies a class to it. So it allows a certain option of
overwriting,
hiding something in your DOM, and especially if you want to run some JavaScript and then move the content of that text field or whatever. Somewhere else, which sometimes happens if you're working with certain limited widgets, that could apply. And I know it's an anti-pattern, right? But we all know as well.
There's buttons for that as well. Hide on phone, hide on tablet.
Yeah, we're getting lots more options. But if we're talking Mendix 8 and you styling requirements that are through the roof, so someone wants a Ferrari maybe, and these options are not available out of the box in Mendix, then sometimes we had to use these kinds of constructions, which we'd preferably not. But again, what is quality, right? So if the client wants X and it really has to be done and you're advising against it, you're having that discussion and still the answer is we still need to implement it, then this could be an option.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on the main SCSS part. I'm a very pragmatic person, and you know, before SCSS there was only CSS, and back then they also put lots of styling in one place, and they had these commented out headers sometimes 5 lines long, so you could see really well when you were scrolling which part of the website or whatever you were looking at its styling, and at some point those files became so large that they had to split it up into smaller sections, or they had to reuse parameters or whatnot. But there was a point when it was fine, and then there was a point when it was too much. And I like that aspect of it. So, okay. So then there's a use case for it. It's okay when it's all in main CSS.
Yeah.
Why? Because there's a reason we started doing it like that. And only when it becomes too much, if that's like from an organizational perspective with multiple apps and whatever, only when it becomes too much, you can go into the folder structure and then it boils down
to having that discussion, right? And having a proper agreement on what should be done afterward. A friend of mine also says that, hey, dry is nice, right? The don't repeat yourself.
Yeah.
A principle, but we should basically have regenerable throwaway code in a sense. So he's actually saying that, hey, if I have the option to generate, for instance, inline styling, and I can also throw it out just as easily and it will work everywhere and really elegantly, so it's generated upon each refresh, then the principle of dry, the question is if that is still relevant. So, and somewhere within Mendix, in this case, we were discussing automatically generating an entity and then your create microflow, your delete microflow, and all of those bits which you probably rebuild every implementation because you want control upon creation and deletion and commits, etc. That stuff he generated by using the Mendix API, so the development API, what's it called again? SDK.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then he's also saying, then the worth of having that model, there is no worth. So basically we can throw it out. And because you can throw it out so easily.
The model.
It can just be regenerated. So a new project with the same code can just as easily be generated. That's what he's doing. And that also gives a different idea of what is quality then, because if the issue of don't repeat yourself is invalid because code is generated.
But you're talking about an intra project. So it means that once you've solved the reusability in the script instead of in the code. So
basically
a script that creates code.
Yeah, he has an app, a Mendix app generator, in which he defines a domain with certain rules, and then he presses a button and bam, you've got your Mendix app. And you can generate it 100 times. And you can have changes and you can start extending it, but that offers a sort of a measure of throwaway code.
Yeah. Although you have to look at, so when you're, let's say, addressing the validity of the data of a certain entity, so your validation microflow, for example, and let's say, okay, I have these functions and they check the validity of the data before or after the user interacts with it, or before I put it in a database, or as a prerequisite of a function. But either way, there are these criteria to my data, and I want to reuse these criteria in like 60 different parts of my process or my application, because these are the criteria of my data. The effort it takes to write a script that would then generate those criteria.
An application.
Criteria. Okay. Or because I'm talking inter-project, not intra-project, but inter-project. So in this case, you make one good function, or maybe a few, that where everybody can see, all right, these are the criteria for the data.
Mm-hmm.
And then you reuse those through the application. So that part of dry is solid and would not be helped with a script, right? Because
let me give another example,
because there's two dimensions, right? So we're talking about the dimension where you enter maybe lots of different projects where you encounter the same like technical fundamental problem, and you want to address that easily because you don't want to spend your weeks doing the same thing over and over.
But maybe let's.
That's aspect of dry.
Can we focus on an example?
Yeah,
maybe.
And then there's another axis where it's one project and there's many parts in different processes that want to reuse certain functions.
Exactly. So if we look, basically what I'm trying to say is some parts or some blocks in Mendix, if you call them, they can be just as easily thrown away. What is the value in it? So that's basically what I'm asking here. And I think one of these examples is, for instance, you probably know that if you're calling an act microflow, right? So that's something that's on a button on a screen. Yeah. And usually it calls on something of a sub-process thing that is on a server. Yeah. And then maybe it toggles a screen or something like that. And maybe there's a validation in there. But we'd like to have this separation of responsibilities, right? So let's imagine that this sub-process only occurs once. And the only thing it does is it does a retrieve, a general retrieve of one entity, no XPath constraint whatsoever, and it only occurs in one place. I know of people who would say, hey, in terms of quality, I want you to implement this sub in this way because that is quality. For me personally, I like the idea of throwaway logic in this case. Mendix is already a type of Mendix low code, right? So if we do that retrieve, that is already a block in itself. When I use the block twice, that is when I start thinking of abstracting it away into a sub, for instance. And this is something, okay. So the concept of a logic that you can throw away, in a sense, a block for me, is something you can definitely throw away. Just like inline styling, if it's there once, and if it has a function, and you really need to implement something inline, okay, you might be able to put it in there. So if there's a use case, but anyway,
I almost got there, like on the same like frequency. I missed you on the retrieve in a sub. So if I retrieve, if I do a retrieve action,
mm-hmm.
some I don't build. If there's no explicit added value mm-hmm. around the retrieve.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there's just some sorting or some mm-hmm. ordering or some craziness around it. I would never build it in a sub flow.
Okay.
Because it's already.
How about a DS current user that is only present in your application in one place? Is that a DS also subable? Can you use that DS in an act, maybe? Would you then create a sub current user retrieve?
Oh yeah, because it has a cast in it. And there's logic, right? There's logic. There's a green little square. There's a red little square, and it has a cast current account. And so that means there's logic. Yeah. There's multiple exits to a a function.
And obviously there's an access
a function
rule.
Deserves its own. Its own microflow, because it's literally a function is a microflow.
I do know of people who can test this, where they're saying that, hey, this is something that's so generic, and this DS that we're using, whether we're calling it in an act or somewhere else, it doesn't really matter that there's this extra access rule. You can use it generically, so why not? And I think it's worth having this discussion. I think quality in the end boils down to having a discussion about what are we going to do in this project, yes or no.
Yeah, folder structures and naming. So is for me definitely somewhere of the flexible layer where I listen to whoever cares about those things. And then I'll follow their naming convention or folder structure. I don't see that as I would keep it lean from my own perspective, and, mm-hmm. and let's please have one way of structuring it. But other than that, so putting a DS, reusing a DSS server side, there are projects where you don't want to do that,
mm-hmm.
Because if you're in a project with lots of juniors,
mm-hmm.
I sometimes put extra focus on what are you doing client side, what are you doing server side,
yeah.
And I especially when it comes to entity access on also on the server side to have that covered. So the more secure, when security becomes very high level, then I would definitely say a data source, Microflow calls something else, and that just like an activity calls something else, because then you're something else is then reused server side for specific.
And we agree on this
for specific client triggered.
But from a throwaway, right? If you're saying, hey, logic should be completely regenerable, and some people do say that. So,
but then, it's hard then to it have opens up the discussion. It's hard to have the scripts to be able to generate everything. That's basically our job.
Yeah. The next guest you need to talk to is that friend of mine, I think. So
that's a very good suggestion.
Recommendation. Yeah. Yeah,
you can. I don't think you can name drop it, or maybe he doesn't appreciate that.
Oh, okay, yeah, he'll probably. Marien Krauw will shout out to you wherever you are. He's a good friend, and we regularly have these discussions on what is quality and what not. Okay. And he's really pushing the boundary with Mendix.
All right, that's amazing. Because the question was, of course, like, what is quality to you? And, well, as we can see, quality is a widespread thing which occurs in every aspect of the Mendix development. You guys talked about the throwaway code, about UI, performance, even the inter-project things, right? Yeah. So it's very styling. Widespread. Styling. So, and that's why talking about quality is such a nice topic. And I think it's you know, it's not a one thing. Like Leon also said, like, it's a very gray area. Like, it's super variable. Like, it can be all sorts of things depending on the project. So, it's great to hear you two guys talk about it and have discussions about it. I think it would be nice to maybe go a bit more in depth in one of these topics. Mm-hmm. I think you briefly touched it a little bit already. And it's something that I'm curious about what your guys' thoughts are.
Okay. Interesting.
The topic is more about the differences in quality between maybe the smaller new projects and when you are already involved in like a big project with multiple teams, for example, or when there is already like a whole project in there. Like, do the quality aspects change between like small projects and large projects with maybe multiple teams as well?
Yeah, interesting subject.
Yeah, they definitely do. So the whole idea of what is quality, right? It's not something that's localized to this table. I think every company that has its own software is discussing the term quality in that sense. And I think scale is really an impactor in that sense. So imagine you're implementing your first Mendix application and you're asking some advice. Maybe you're calling in an experienced Mendix site to help you out. And then you've got your first app. But there was no such thing as a styling module. And there was no such thing as a validation module or a customized starting module for the company or
best practices.
We still have Mendix best practices, right? So they're pretty complete, I'd say. But maybe this is a financial client, right? So maybe there are various policies and rules and compliance aspects that need to be present within the code. And then it may become clear after that first project that parts of these aspects are repeatable. So then quality becomes more about standardizing and about taking out these bits that are very prevalent in code and making sure that you can reuse them across applications. So yes, the scale of the venture is definitely having an effect on the discussion of quality, I'd say. Or do you disagree?
Definitely agree. What I try with greenfield smaller applications, I try to focus more on reducing complexity. I think that because it's hard for people to get it elegantly right. where they, because they're trying things out. So when I look at these applications, I find them, you know, going to the sixth floor in order to end up on the third floor. So they're not elegant. So and to find that elegance is most important for those starting apps, because they never end there. They usually grow into something bigger.
Can you give an example?
Well, they would. It's very small things where they would do things in a loop that can be done with aggregated functions. Mm-hmm. It can be things where they
put the XPath on the retrieve instead of on the entity, maybe.
Yeah. That's moving complexity, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's more in the lines of just elaborate. You're making a local variable, and then you're doing this and that, and then over there, and you're putting it in a non-persistable object in order to pass it to another microflow, and it's just not eloquent.
Yeah.
It's not. It's
just, and it just usually has to do with the background of the person starting out with Mendix.
Yeah. I don't care about the why. I care about elegant code at that point, because it works.
Can I give a funny example?
Sorry to interrupt you.
So I was once in a project, and that project was a greenfield project and a fintech project as well. And they had an offshore team, and the offshore team was very familiar with jQuery. So it's a relic, I think, from 2008, 2005-ish.
Yeah.
They did all the styling of the Mendix application via jQuery.
Okay, so they used the HTML snippet in all the pages, and they added their styling there.
In jQuery.
Yeah.
So that's something I recognize. And so, that's going to the sixth floor while you could have gone directly to the third. Yeah.
And so I always find it a challenge to look at a microflow of, I don't know, 20 or 30 blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you can reduce that to only 10 or 12. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the most important part of apps that are just starting, because once they're out there, once there are these big monoliths, it sometimes becomes too dangerous, because there's a lot of stuff relying on these functions, so you can't just go around and say we need to cut this in half, this dragon, because that's, you know, it's, and then people come up, yeah, but we have to build it in microservices and we have to do this or that to prevent it. I said no, you just need eloquent code. You just need to focus on that the most when you're starting, because whatever you end up doing afterwards will be easier. I don't care if you're applying dry, yes or no. If it's eloquent, it doesn't matter, because you'll see the same pattern twice, and if you want to put it in a sub, then you can put it in a sub.
Yeah.
So, but eloquent code is that I focus on the most. Keep it simple, stupid, and that's what new people, because it goes like this: they try something, then they try something else, then they add something, and then they see something else is missing, so that they'll retrieve something, then they'll try it again, and then it works, I won't touch it anymore, and then it's a microflow that's really long, and that's what you see the most in cases where people started and then I come in with the quality flag, you know, and then that's where I focus on.
Yeah, about. Teacher Leon. No, this is wrong.
Well, actually,
yeah. That's sometimes, you know, I think that touches on something else, that usually you have some sort of a disparity amongst your team, right? So one person is more experienced than another. But it's also a democracy, right? In a sprint or in a scrum team, we're all similars, right? So that's exactly the point of having a scrum team.
Yeah.
And then these levels of experience where you're saying, hey, you could probably optimize this. At some point in time, I ran into situations where people just didn't want to optimize anymore. And I found that to be very difficult personally.
Yeah.
And especially when it touches upon things that...
Because I like the
something
sixth
becomes.
Yeah, I like the sixth floor.
Yeah. But maybe it's that. So there was once an example, maybe. I like using recursion because it's so elegant. So every now and then, when, for instance, you have self-references and you really want to get the whole hierarchy of data that's attached,
you don't have an infinite possible infinite.
And so in this case, we'd already had two instances of this. So one with it doesn't really matter. So there were two entities with self-references in which we had a hierarchy of data, and for the one entity, we'd already used recursion to really efficiently retrieve all data in the hierarchy, starting from top to all the way to the bottom, etc. So I'd asked, in this case, the team to create a duplicate version for the other entity. It's really simple, right? So this one was already working. It had been tested.
Yeah.
You just copy the flow, change the entity, run the whole thing, and bam. Yeah.
And there's checks and balances not to get into an infinite
situation. And you don't run into the fact that you're getting more variation in code, but that everything is uniform and probably more maintainable. And in this case, that person decided, well, this has already been done, so there's no challenge. So what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to implement a loop, and I'm going to use a list, and I'm going to use the main entity and put that in a list, and then I'm going to loop over the entity and change the list while I'm looping over it. Which is an anti-pattern. At least that's what I was taught in university, but that was the implementation choice. And so this discussion of quality, it turned a bit sour in the end, because I'd asked something very simple and I didn't get it. As just an example, but things can, discussions of quality can sometimes also be difficult.
Yeah, it's basically the same thing, but different.
Yeah, and in this case, there was more experience, right? So it's in a sense, I think it's easy if you're in a greenfield situation with a young team, where you can basically say, "Hey, this is how we should do it." But it becomes more difficult if there's more experience in the same team. Yeah,
I can get that. And then what would be important when once you reach at scale, word we heard a few years ago a lot was the app factory, Siemens factories, and then what would be the main quality driver?
The differences between quality in smaller teams versus the more bigger teams, like what kind of you make different choices, I guess, based on the size.
In the scale, once they're at scale and you reach a point where it becomes more organizational than technical. So you would have different guilds that would have to align on things. You would have and that's basically it. And those translate into the code. So what I try to do there is to keep people pick a specialty. You know, everybody can pick a specialty in the team and reach out to somebody else with that specialty in the other teams and make sure you meet at the end of every sprint just to vibe, just to say, what did you guys do UX? What did you guys do testing? What did you guys do? And then just pick a specialty, because that way there is more alignment in how things are solved. Oh, that's interesting. We also added that and wanted to add that and that maybe to the design system, et cetera, et cetera. So not to have a linking pin in a center of excellence, because they spend their whole day in meetings. And I like more the aspect of the
direct contact,
the verticals and the horizontals, where you would be in a team, but you would also be a specialist and align with the other teams. I like that. I think sometimes organizations see that as overhead, but once there's something at scale and that's not there yet, then I want to focus on that because I believe that really helps quality in the end.
A very good addition, I think, to the question. Yeah, definitely. And it's great to see that you both have very good you have experience in both like smaller projects, like the greenfield projects you were talking about, and bigger projects, right, with guilds and stuff, and probably like also a separation of responsibilities there. And you were talking about when you're in a project with multiple experts, you have like you call it a democracy, right? Yeah.
Should it be or should it not be? Should there be a lead developer in a team, for instance?
I was thinking about that. It makes things easier if there's a lead developer.
Why?
And because you can still supplement, mm-hmm. but you can trust the other person to make the judgment calls in that project. So I can still I can still be really good at making good code as a let's say you're the lead developer,
mm-hmm.
And then me being a professional. I should not want to be two captains on the ship. You know, mm-hmm. this ship, you're the captain. There's a reason why a ship has a captain and a story. And I can be very experienced. And mm-hmm. of course, you as a good captain can recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can offer other solutions and we can vibe together. But we don't want, hey, it's Tuesday and Leon is working. And then Leon can make a judgment call. And then I know that Leon likes it this way, even though Wouter likes it that way. So I'm all for, because if you're both professional, you know, next ship, I'll be the captain. You know, so and I
don't
mind.
You have no issue with that personally.
I don't mind introducing a wee bit of authority into mm-hmm. Agile, because you know, pokering together, we're doing it together. There's already enough of it, so I don't mind a slight bit of authority.
And to me, you know, it also depends, right, on the team and on the people you're working with. But
and I can adjust to it.
It can be very practical to have one person be accountable.
Yeah,
and that one person can then also have the difficult task of having the sometimes more difficult discussions with the client when it comes down to budget, timelines, deadlines, etc., and the implications of maybe delivering a function that's a bit smaller versus a very elaborate one, or maybe just one function instead of 10. Right? We've all been in that situation probably, and then it's usually handier to have one person at the table versus a whole team. But then again, I think from a Scrum perspective, right, the lead developer shouldn't exist. And
is that Scrum? It's been a while since I took
Yeah, Scrum the Agile, right? So there are no lead developers. We're all the same. We're uniform. We're doing the work together, etc. And sometimes, you know, I'd like it to be democracy, but it's also sometimes a struggle to deal with that.
For me,
at least.
Yeah, and sometimes I like to tell somebody with who might have less experience than me, and I want that. I'll say you'll be tech lead for this project. I'll just fly by. You can spar with me, of course.
Yeah.
Because how else? You know, how else can people ever?
Will it impact the quality?
No, because if you're there, you're still there. Mm. And multiple roads lead to Rome. Especially if that person is with an end client that has to DevOps the project, and I'm only there for the dev and the first bit of the DevOps, then definitely I want that person to be responsible, feel the responsibility, even though I might be more experienced. And I think in the end, because that person feels more ownership, takes more responsibility, in the end, that's just as well helping quality down the line.
Yeah, it's great to hear your thoughts about it. I think we might have time for another last discussion topic.
Yeah, when I was thinking about with regards to this is the guidelines aspect of things, right? So that's the bottom up
part. Best practices, you mean?
But more in the lines of bottom up is, you know, the expert knows what he's doing, and that's mm-hmm. that will translate into quality. And the top down approach is you will do it this way mm-hmm. because then we have some minimum level of quality assured bureaucratically or guidelines, mm-hmm. best practices, name it what you want. But that's, you know, another aspect of authority, you know, the checklist. Did you make unit test? When did you see it work? When did you see it have a lot of benefit, such structures? And when did you see it fail?
Okay, so you mean like quality guidelines in issues or stories?
Yeah.
To mm-hmm. checklists with a lot of checklists. Did you do a unit test? Yeah. Did you do? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So when did we see it work? When did we see it fail?
With regards to
usually
guidelines,
that's
right?
The first thing companies, you know, the project managers and the decision makers, that's the first thing they think about if they hear quality driven design. Oh, then lots of checklist. Did you do this? Did you do that?
Yeah. Even though the first discussion said like quality is a wide aspect, right? It's a wide range of colors.
I think it's a really interesting topic. I think in all of the projects that I've seen, every project had its own version of some sort of a quality standard with regard to issues in Jira or Azure DevOps or Mendix Sprint or whatever.
Scores in code readout tools. It has to have a 4 in AQM. Otherwise, you're not allowed to deploy it to production.
Yeah, or something like this Jira issue has to have points allotted to it, otherwise we won't be able to implement.
Yeah,
that's also a really interesting one. So for me, I always try to be flexible with what the client needs. There is a minimum, though. I try to have an actual user story. I think that that's a minimum that should be there. So the administrator as an administrator, I can take a look at the entire database of users or something, whatever, you know. That's a minimum, and then with that come a number of acceptance criteria, usually, because that one user story can't tell everything. So you probably have a checklist with, you can delete something, you can open an overview, right? So that's something you wouldn't want in the user story itself, because that's a detail that is pretty irrelevant until you implement it.
Yeah.
But once you have implemented it, you can actually check that is actually in there. Yeah. Because then later on, if you ever want to transfer to another technology, you can just rebuild it, presumably, because it's also sometimes technology dependent.
Yeah.
But those two bits I try to combine, and whether you'd call it test criteria or acceptance criteria, for me, that's the minimum.
Yeah, as a user story.
Yeah.
Basically, with the description. Yeah.
And anything else? Do we have a unit test, etc.? That in principle, if you have proper acceptance criteria and you can manually test everything, then the whole idea of having a unit test, yes or no, that is something that you can discuss.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, Mendix already takes away a lot of the basic testing of blocks, right? So should we do a unit test on a retrieve sub that has no XPath constraint?
You can't.
You can. Of course you can. You can test everything.
Yeah, okay.
You can test everything.
But that's
the whole idea is you only test those bits that are critical and prone to change and breaking.
You won't have scenarios. Yeah, you don't have scenarios and it can't change.
Yeah. So the idea here is that we trust what Mendix does for us.
Yeah.
In principle.
Of course, I trust
sometimes them, there are unexpected side effects, but that's also the challenge of working with Mendix,
I trust them with my whole career.
Same goes for me.
It's my livelihood. Yeah.
And that's why, by the way, also like being an MVP, right? So if there is an issue, then we can address it quite quickly. Shout out to the product manager team at Mendix. So, yeah.
Yeah. Now, times where I've seen it work is where, yeah. So have I seen it work? Have I seen degradation of quality by using those type of standards? So have I seen better microflows when it had a score 4 on AQM? Or have I seen worse microphones when it had to have a score 4 on AQM? And that's where for me it's very gray. I think it's 50-50. And that means it didn't have that means like you might as well not do it, right? Which is scary. Because it also means that those tools were mainly built on like traditional. I know there's some new ones out there that mm-hmm. have a better understanding of the Mendix blocks. But when the times when I've seen it fail was when traditional code was still, you know, AQM, ACR. In the beginning, they had to adjust to, you know, what is a good microflow. And it could be that I believe that if I believe that there was something about certain aspects of a microflow. I think when you did a mapping or when you did something else, mm-hmm. and it was always flagged as those are too many lines of code.
Oh yeah,
it's more than 100 lines of code, and then flagged, red flag, bad score.
Or like object type decisions. So every now and then you just want to actually go through the decision without having the cast.
Yeah, but
that decision is something that's reflected as a reproduction. So that'll downgrade your score.
Score, yeah. and as somebody who's an expert or a specialist, you never like those kind of things, right? This number doesn't represent the actual complexity of what we're doing here, and you can never, and it will give a skewed. It would give a skewed image of the actual code, because I've seen really bad functions, but they had a great score.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because a certain thing that could never it was scattered all over the place, like mm-hmm. like a 52 pickup, right? You grab a card deck and you throw it around the room, 52 pickup.
Mm-hmm.
It was like that. So there was something the system had to do, but it was chopped up into gibberish. It was a piece of paper with the story on it, and it was put through the shredder, and separate parts of the paper were pasted all around. But those separate parts, those functions were really nice. They had only two incoming parameters.
Mm-hmm.
They had only a maximum of 8 blocks, and they had the highest score on AQM.
Mm-hmm.
But
it was completely legible and difficult to maintain.
It was an impossible piece of code.
Yeah.
But it had it was sublime scoring on the scoring card. So that's why I've seen quality tools fail in providing quality in the past.
Is this also something where Mendix still needs to do some work? I'm wondering. So I was just brushing
they
up.
Have, on yeah, they so they I yeah. think they acquired if the quality.
If I may finish my point.
Of
so
course.
I was brushing up on my Java a couple of weeks back when I thought, let's take another look at that course that I still had lying around that I wanted to finish. So I'd started doing this quite some time ago, and I was revisiting it, and I thought this project of encapsulating functions and having private functions and private attributes, I think that's really nice. And you know, in Mendix, we always need to implement a microflow for that dedicated to a certain function. We can't override, say, the create function of an entity, right? We can block it through an access rule and then force someone to use a microflow. That's basically what we can do.
Yeah.
That type of encapsulation, I think it would be cool if we would be able to tweak some bits there, where you could just say, hey, instead of giving an access right for a creation, we could just link our own microflow to it. So you never have to think of creation again. That is where I think that would be a cool improvement.
Yeah, that's too abstract. I can't picture it.
So basically, let's talk about validation then.
Yeah,
validation
is
something that you can do in the client, in a microflow. You can do it within the form, right?
Yeah.
So you have a validation rule
then
setting,
on
I think,
both sides,
on a form. So there are many options of doing that. And probably you can also validate right within the XPath constraints that you put within an entity itself, right? So the question here is, you have events that you can put on an entity. So there are loads of options to validate. I would like to have the option of having full control of what a validation means for an entity, and okay. only define once in the code what that is supposed to be. By the way, shout out to Jonathan Deal at Mendix. Product manager for the runtime, amongst other things.
Yeah.
So this requirement is in scope with them, but it just takes a lot of work. But
usually,
but this would be a nice form of encapsulation.
I understand the requirement now. Although most of the time, there are many points in time where a different criteria applies, right? Mm-hmm. So when somebody's filling out the form, there are certain things he should fill out, and then mm-hmm. we're sending it to an AI, and then we expect that AI to bring back 3 or 4 things that should be filled out, and then mm-hmm. we're sending it to some other function.
Context.
Yeah? So internal Java function, and then after that function is done, I'm expecting certain criteria to be valid, and then I can put it in a database. So there's that the input field, which mm-hmm. is basically you could
client side validation.
You could do it a client side. You could do it whatever. And then there is
the server. It needs to be server validated.
Then there's your integration with certain prerequisites and a certain expected outcome.
Yeah.
So there's lots of points in time where different stuff has to be valid.
Yeah.
So how would you then say I want one point where I can put that, because
and now we're talking about the details of a possible implementation of being able to. So
that's why I like examples.
Yeah. But I'm giving this example for a reason, because there are ways, obviously, in which you would be able to call certain aspects. So say I want to validate these 3 attributes with the standard rule, for instance. Then you just check the 3 attributes, right? So that could be a form of implementation of this. But what I'm basically saying is that I'd like to have a bit more control of what encapsulation within Mendix means. So I'll give another example. So for instance, if you
I think I get it. So on a create action, when you double click a create action,
I want to have control.
You want to tick the boxes and say if these aren't present.
The association needs to be present. We're giving that automatically.
If you do a commit action, you want to have a separate tab and you want to tick, tick, tick. When this is committed, I want this.
So basically in one place within Mendix for an entity where taking control.
Oh, I thought it was on the action
encapsulated
itself.
Control. Then any other place within the application doesn't have to know about the complexity that is residing within that bit, just like within classes where you have in Java, where you have encapsulation, private entities, or private attributes, or even entities as a possibility if you have a relation, well, et cetera, et cetera. That is, I think, where maybe we can improve quality of the implementation a bit more. Future implementations within Mendix, because a lot of the complexity usually comes from building an act create and an act delete and an act save, and then that is what takes most time, probably.
Yeah, but time is not always complex. So
yeah.
So I like the repetitive legwork, because that's a great way for the juniors to learn Mendix. If there was no repetitive legwork anymore, how would you ever learn? How would you ever learn, right?
Yeah, so in the age of AI, this is a very dangerous situation to have repetitive work.
It's a great thing for humans as well to train, not only the robot. Okay. Interesting. Right. Interesting.
So, I think we will round up our discussion. But it was amazing to have you guys here and talk about quality. I think we talked about lots of different aspects of quality, and I think you both gave some very valuable insights to the listeners about what to think about, how the quality differs from projects, experiences, right? So I want to thank you both from the bottom of my heart for coming here. It was wonderful. And thanks again for Supersteria for hosting again. And let's keep this podcast going for the next series.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Emil.
Thank you. And thanks for having us, Soccer, as well.